John Claypool tells a story of a Saturday afternoon in Jackson, Mississippi. And yes, I'm going to have to come drink water about every 3 minutes. Please don't tell the Methodist that I brought drink into the... Yeah, I know. Of a Saturday afternoon in Jackson, Mississippi. And there was a young husband and father who was sprawled out on the couch watching a ball game on TV with a beer in his hand. His wife walked through the room with an armload of laundry and made some passing comment to him about his drinking too much. And that's all he needed to light a very short fuse. He jumped up from that couch and he snapped something back at her about minding her own business, and she didn't know what she was talking about. And he stormed out the back door and he got to his pickup in the driveway and he started it up, jumped in, put it in reverse, and squealed back in the driveway because he wanted her to hear his displeasure. And just about the time he was about to hit the street, he heard a scream and a thud and a sickening sound beneath the wheels of his truck. And he got up to find that in his rage, he had not even noticed that his 3-year-old son had followed Daddy out and now was dead at the end of their driveway. Claypool was the pastor of that young family's church and one of the very first people to get there. And in writing about that moment later, he said, "I have never seen a human being as deeply grieved in spirit as that young man was." Thank you. Thanks, bud. I'll take it. Most of you know that I spent my 35th birthday in an intense care, lockdown, drug rehab facility. Now, at that time, I had been a full-time pastor for over 10 years. And I was the lead pastor of one of the largest churches of my denomination in the world at that time. So you would automatically assume, of course, that I was there to minister to those sickos in that rehab center. And if you've known me 10 minutes, you know I was a sicko in that rehab center. Nobody in my church knew what I was going through because I didn't trust them. Ever been to a church you didn't trust? Aren't you glad we're here? There is nothing I couldn't share with you, and there's most of my life I couldn't have said those words. I didn't trust them. I had 6 months clean and sober, going every day and twice most days to my original home group of NA in Arlington, and hiding and sneaking in and out of meetings and struggling desperately. Until finally, it was my wife who made the decision. She said, "I understand that you found a place that would wonderful and would help you. Why don't you go? Spend some time with those people." I said, "Honey, none of those people at our church know anything about any of this with me. I'll have to tell them something if I'm going to be gone for a month or so." And I said, "What am I going to tell them?" She said, "I don't know. How about the truth?" And I said, "Honey, if I get up and tell that church that their pastor is a drug addict and an alcoholic fighting for his life, that may be the last sermon I ever preach in that church, and very likely the last sermon I'd preach anywhere. I mean, who's got on their on there. We're looking for a pastor search committee. We're looking for a junkie and preferably a drunk if one of them is available to come be our pastor. Not a lot of openings in that category in my profession. And I said, what am I going to tell them? She said, the truth. And I said, I may never preach again if I tell them this. And she said, it's the right thing to do. I married one of those. It's the right thing to do. She said, if we could put Jesus right there on the couch, what would he say? She said, I think he'd say, confess to each other and pray for each other so you may be healed. She said, it's the right thing to do. And she said, if we find out it was wrong to do right at that church, I don't want to raise my babies there anyway. And I stood up that Sunday before I checked myself into that place that did help save my life and told them my story as plainly as I could tell it. And I was right. It was the last time I ever was allowed to stand in that pulpit ever again. After I got home and they had tortured me for a few months, they picked up what was left of me and threw it out in the street and said that I could, their words, we don't think you can ever be effective again. So here's the question. Open your bulletins to the inside right-hand side. How do you respond when you've blown it? When you knew better and sinned anyway? That young man in Jackson, Mississippi, told John Claypool, his pastor, he said, every time I close my eyes, all I can see is my little boy lying dead in the street. How can I go on living when I've killed my own flesh and blood? 2 days later, after I checked into that rehab and it swept over me the enormity of what I had done with being honest with those folks, at the end of our AA meeting that closed out the day, I went and sat on the steps and sobbed, heaved sobs. And I said, God, will anything ever be all right for me again? Will anybody ever want to hear me speak for you again? What do we do when we've blown it? When we knew better and we did it anyway. And now we're so deep in the sickness of it, we think we might drown. That woman I was describing to you who has spent the last 44 years beside me is the best human being I've ever met in my life. I love that woman so fiercely that if somebody were to walk through that door right now and say, John, somebody needs to die so that Kay can continue to live, I would die in my next breath for her and not even bat an eye to do it. But as much as I love her, of the things in my life, the things that God has done, her love is not even the sweetest thing in my life. I love my kids. Okay, for many of you, I'm about to pull out the gold standard. I love my grandkids so much. Tell me if this makes sense to you, what I'm about to say. I love them so much that sometimes the sheer size of the emotion is almost physically painful. Do you know what I'm saying? I know you do. I love those kids that much. But get ready to write this. When I have purposefully, willfully hurt my God, and I'm grieving over it, even my wife and my children are not the sweetest thing to me. His forgiveness is the sweetest single thing on planet Earth. It's a story that's been told till everybody could quote every detail of it, and I'm just going to spend about that long tapping into it quickly. In 2 Samuel chapter 11, we have one, write this down. We have one of the most dangerous things on earth. A man with too much time on his hands. One of the most dangerous things on earth. Jesselyn! Okay. That's perfect. A man with too much time on his hands. I spent several months earlier this year talking to you about my boy King David. And David finally conquered his kingdom. He built his palace. He was at the peak of everything in his life, and he had just completed this magnificent palace. And there were still some skirmishes out on the edge of the kingdom that he really needed to tend to. But you know what? He's got this palace. And he's got all these wives and concubines, the most beautiful women in Israel, in that palace. So all kinds of reasons he wouldn't want to leave that palace. So he sent his troops out to fight his battles on the skirmishes along the border to keep his people safe. Now clearly, he was commander-in-chief of Israel's army. That was his job. But suddenly he had too much time on his hands. And he's walking around on the rooftop terrace of his new palace, and he looks over the railing and down the hill. He sees a woman taking a bath behind her house. Now, the exact translation, I'm told by biblical language scholars, of the next verse goes exactly like this. She was good of appearance, very. She was good of appearance, very. The New Revised Featherston translation says that was one hot babe down the hill. And he wanted her. And he called for his servants and said, go bring her up here to me. And I loved the servant's answer, very wisely worded. His servant says, oh, your majesty, that's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. He didn't even call her by name. He said, oh, that's Bathsheba down there. It's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Tells us two things in one sentence. Wise man with his answer. Number one, it says, first of all, she's married. Keep your hands off her. She doesn't belong to you. And number two, she is married to one of your closest friends in life. There was this tiny circle of David fanatics, men who were utterly, completely committed to David. And they took a vow, these men, that they would, without hesitation, die for David. And they were known throughout the kingdom in those days and until this day as the mighty men of David. Uriah the Hittite was one of those men who was so completely devoted to David, he would gladly die for his king. That's the wife of Uriah the Hittite, your majesty. He didn't care. He's like so many of us. We want what we want when we want it. And he sent for her, brought her up, committed adultery with his friend's wife, and sent her back down the hill. And he thought he had pulled a fast one on God. How many times in my life have I thought I pulled a fast one on God? A few weeks or perhaps months later, Bathsheba sends word back up the hill that she's pregnant. And what we know for sure is not her husband's baby. He spent months out on the outskirts of the kingdom doing David's dirty work for him. There is no question whose child that baby is. So he puts a plan in place and sends word for Uriah to come back and give a report of what's going on in the battles. Clearly, he didn't need a report from Uriah. He wanted Uriah to spend the night at home so he could give Uriah credit for this upcoming child. And so he comes and gives a report to David. And he said, David said, now go down there and enjoy the night with that beautiful wife of yours. Uriah, don't you hate men of honor, you know? Uriah said, I can't do that. My brothers are out fighting your battles for you on the edge of the kingdom. It's not right for me to go enjoy my wife when the men I fight beside cannot enjoy theirs. And so he slept on the porch. David was furious. And so he puts together a plan. He writes a secret note to the lead commander commanding Uriah in the battles, and says, I want you to put Uriah right out in front of the battle line and tell secretly all the men around him that at your signal, they will all pull back and leave him alone out there on the front of the battle. And he sealed it and he gave it to Uriah to take back. Uriah carried that message back that would be his death. And it happened just like David planned. David immediately brought Bathsheba up, married her, and covered his bases. He thought. And once again, now he knows he's really pulled a fast one on God. See, God wanted so badly for David to know the scale of what he had done. So he sends the preacher, Nathan, the prophet. And Nathan comes to the throne room for a meeting with David. David invites him in and he said, David, as king of Israel, you are the Supreme Court. You make the final decisions on law and punishments. So I've got one that I'm really wrestling with and I need you to decree how this should be handled. He said, here's the story. He said, there are these two neighbors that live side by side with a hedge between them. The neighbor over here is fabulously wealthy. Flocks and herds all over the hills as far as the eye can see. The next door neighbor on this side, he is desperately poor. In fact, the only livestock they have is one little ewe lamb. And you have to understand, David, that lamb is not livestock to him. It's the family pet. They love that lamb like a child. One day the rich people had company come in, and they sent their servants over the hedge because they didn't want to mess with their thousands of livestock all over the hills. They didn't want to bother with theirs. They sent their servants over to kidnap the family pet next door and slaughter it and feed it to their company. What do you think ought to be done? David was furious. Furious. He said, that's the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, the law says they should return threefold for what they took. But with God as my witness, somebody slimy enough to do a thing like that really deserves to die. Tell me who it is. I'll take care of it. And Nathan looks at him and says, it's you. It's you. You did that. You had a palace full of the most beautiful women in the kingdom at your disposal. Your buddy who loved you literally more than his life, had one woman that he loved with all his heart. And when he left, you went and stole her and killed him to cover it up. Jew. Wouldn't you love to have crawled into David's head at that moment? Wouldn't you love to hear David's thoughts at that moment? Wouldn't you love to know what the exchange was between heaven and earth and the Spirit and David at that moment? Well, I've got good news for you. I can give you that. If you've got a Bible to turn in, turn to Psalms 51. At the head of Psalms 51, it says, "For the director of music, a psalm of David, when the prophet Nathan came to him after David had committed adultery with Bathsheba." That was not added recently. That introduction to this psalm was attached to it when the psalm was written by David, to explain to us what's going on while David's writing these words. Listen to the inside of David's head that day. "Have mercy. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion. Blot out my transgressions. Wash away my iniquity. Cleanse me from sin. For I know my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. Against you, you only have I sinned. I've done what is evil in your sight. You are right in your verdict and justified when you judge." Verse 14. "Deliver me from the guilt of bloodshed, O God, you who are God, my Savior, and my tongue will sing of your righteousness. Open my lips and my mouth will declare your praise. You don't delight in sacrifice, or I'd bring it. You don't take pleasure in burnt offerings. My sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise." God loved David so profoundly because, write this down, David understood the forgiveness of God. A couple of quick points that I want you to write down and listen to carefully, because you want to carry these with you this week. Here's the first one. Write it down. Jesus came to forgive us. That's Jesus in a nutshell. That's his whole story. Would you like some good news? Thank you. I'm going to deliver this to the seven who said you wanted it. Would you like some good news? He did not come to forgive clean ones. He came to forgive dirty ones, like, I don't know, all of us. And by the way, your scriptures are there. That's in Matthew 9, Mark 2, Luke 5. How about some more good news? He didn't come to forgive us once or twice or 10,000 times. He came to forgive us as often as is necessary to keep us connected to him so he can usher us all the way home. That's Matthew 18, 21 through 25. The ancient Greeks had a legend about a young lion cub whose mom died giving birth to him. And he would have died quickly, obviously, if it wasn't for a flock of goats, wild goats, that happened to come by and discover him right after he was born. And they took him with them. They adopted him as one of their own. And they taught him to eat what they eat and to sound like they sound. until he almost looked like they looked. One day, the biggest, meanest lion in the jungle comes out into a clearing, utterly flabbergasted, to see one of his own kind eating grass with a bunch of goats. The goats immediately saw him and were gone in a flash. And he walked over to that young one like him, and he took him out on a hunt. And he made his first kill and ate real meat like a real lion. And he taught him how to walk like a lion, to sound like a lion. And then finally he took him down to the river and let him see himself for the first time reflected in the water of the creek. And after his first meal as a lion and seeing who he really was, he stood up, stuck out his chest, and let out a roar. Thrilled to understand for the very first time who and what he really was. You know, the goats that surround us out there want us to look like they look and eat what they eat and act like they act until we become what they become. But that's not who we are. We are a people who were created in the very image of the Lion of Judah. That's who we are. Rather than rising and taking the place of lions in the world around us, we eat grass with the goats. Or in my case, smoked grass with the goats, but that's another story. We grovel beneath our station and dignity, and Jesus comes down and said, I did not create you to be that. I made you in the image of me, the Lion of God's people. And Jesus came to forgive us. Write this down. We have a future in spite of our past. How's that for some news for folks like us in this room? Great John Claypool telling that story about that devastated daddy. He would go by and check on him every few days or every day or I don't know how often, but he said every time he walked in that house, that young man was sitting in the rocker that he had bought for he and his wife to rock that little boy in when he was born. And every day he'd walk in and that man would be in that rocker with his head down in his hands, just rocking back and forth and saying, I want to die. I just want to die. And finally Claypool had enough. And he walked over to that young man and he grabbed his hand, his head between his two hands, and he tilted his head up so they were eyeball to eyeball. And he said, son, I want you to listen to me. The fact that you're still breathing is proof positive that God is not through with you yet. One more story. I could run with this for a while. You kind of hit a topic I'm fond of. Read a story years ago by a preacher who went to pick up his little boy at school on the last day before the Christmas break. And he said, usually the parents all stand at the end of the sidewalk waiting for the kids to run out. And when the bell sounds, those kids just explode out that door. But he said this day was completely different. He said the bell rang and the door very carefully slowly opened up. And all of those kids began to walk out holding something in their hands very carefully like this. He said his son had been hinting for days that they had been making something for their moms and dads for Christmas. It was obvious that they had spent that day making wrappings for whatever that was. He said, you never saw such gaudy glitter and construction papers. Said every one of them looked like a mess, but oh, those kids were so proud. And he said, finally, one little boy came out, and it was cold, and he had forgotten to put on his coat. And so he's wrestling with his coat, but he's not going to take his eyes off his gift for mom and dad. And he's trying to get that arm through that sleeve, and the coat was hanging down and wrapped around his leg. And before anybody could get to him and help him, he took a full face forward fall onto that concrete sidewalk. And as that package in his hand hit the concrete, you could hear a ceramic crash all over the schoolyard. And that little boy was just laying on the ground sobbing with this shattered mess. He said the first one to get to him was his dad. And his dad walked over to him and he just patted him on the head and said, "Oh, son, don't cry. It's all right. I'm sure whatever it is, you can make another one just like it. It's okay." The second one to get to him was his mom. And with the extra 8 layers of insight God only gives moms, and I'm not kidding, and you know I'm right. The next one to get to him was his mom. And with a dress and hose and heels on, coming from work, she got down on her hands and knees in the dirt beside that sidewalk and scooped that little boy up. And with tears in her eyes, she said, "Oh, it does matter. It matters a lot. Let's pick it up and take it home and see what we can make out of the pieces." See, I'm sitting in the dirt with my life a shattered mess. And the world walks by and looks at me and says, "Oh, John, don't worry about it. It's no big deal. You can fix whatever that was. It's not a problem." And then my big brother and yours gets down on his hands and knees in the dirt with me there. And he scoops me up in his arms. And he says, "Oh, John, it does matter. It matters a lot. Let you and I pick it up. Pick up those pieces. Take it home and see what we can make from your pieces." I want to close with a prayer that says all of that to me, and just listen, because it's a prayer you've heard. Once we have admitted our powerlessness, once we come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can fix it, and once we make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to that power that's not me, once I have made a list of all my wrongs and all the damage and all the resentment, and then admit it to somebody else, all of that, and then become really ready to turn it over and let it go, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous suggests that maybe I pray something like this. When ready, we say something like this: "My Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen." We have then completed step 7. Let's stand up and worship.